Support for this episode of Judaism Unbound comes from the Ashman Family JCC in Palo Alto, California, whose vision is to be the architects of the Jewish future. The Ashman Family JCC empowers you to experience Jewish paths toward a life of joy, purpose, and meaning through innovative Jewish learning and wellness programs, community building, and initiatives to develop the next generation of Jewish leaders. Learn more at www.paloaltojcc.org. This is Judaism Unbound, episode 307, Farming is Jewish. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofberg.
And today is December 31st. It's New Year's Eve. So first of all, we want to wish everybody a happy new year. And second of all, if you're listening to this episode on the day that it comes out, there are just a few hours left in the year 2021. Now, this might be a big relief to many of us for whom 2021 wasn't the greatest of years. In any event, another thing that happens at the end of the year is that a lot of people want to make charitable contributions to nonprofit organizations before the end of the tax year. And if that's you, you can do that by going to www.judaismunbound.com/donate, where you have an opportunity to make a one-time gift, which you might want to do at the end of the tax year, but you also have an opportunity to sign up to make a monthly gift. So if you are inclined to make an end-of-year donation to Judaism Unbound and or to sign up for a monthly donation, we don't ask for a lot, but we do really hope that so many of our listeners, especially our more dedicated listeners, will find it in their hearts to contribute to this work to keep it going. So thank you so much for doing that. And now let's turn to today's episode. As we've said a number of times on this show, this year is the Shemitah year, the year of release, the year of resting the land, the year of releasing debts. And we are committed to exploring this idea of Shemitah around once a month. Sometimes our explorations are more metaphorical. Sometimes they're more literal. Today's episode is a more literal look at the Shemitah and its more traditional form. Our guests today are the co-founders of the Jewish Farmer Network, which supports the economic, social, and cultural vibrancy of Jewish agriculture by connecting Jewish farmers to resources and community around the world. It mobilizes Jewish wisdom to build a more just and regenerative food system for all. If you check out the Jewish Farmer Network website, which is jewishfarmernetwork.org, you can actually find a bunch of resources about Shemitah, and you can also see a list of the various programmatic offerings that they have, including an annual conference, which is coming up on January 30th and February 6th. You're invited to register for the conference, and they'd be excited to have you. So let's introduce our guests today, Shani Mink and S.J. Selden. They are the co-founders of the Jewish Farmer Network. S.J. Selden is the board chair of the Jewish Farmer Network. They are the steward in residence of Yesod Farm and Kitchen, a community space near Asheville, North Carolina, dedicated to regenerative agriculture, earth-based Jewish living, and growing relationships across difference. S.J. Selden studied public policy and socioeconomic injustice at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and ever since then has been traveling through America, growing organic produce for donation at educational farms and community gardens, and consulting with organic businesses and community agriculture nonprofits. Our second guest, Shani Mink, is the executive director of the Jewish Farmer Network. She has spent many years as a farmer and experiential Jewish educator, including working as a farmer educator at Eden Village Camp, and managing annual production and livestock operations at the Pearlstone Center for 2 years. As an undergraduate, Shani Mink studied philosophy at St. Mary's College of Maryland, and she recently earned her Master of Science in Organizational Leadership and Innovation and Nonprofit Public Organizational Management at the Zelikow School of Jewish Nonprofit Management, which is part of the Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion. I happen to know that for a fact. Usually I'm just reading things from guest bios, but I know that for a fact because Shani was a member of a class that I taught in that program on applied Jewish wisdom. She was a great student in the class, and I'm thrilled to welcome these two wonderful leaders of the Jewish Farmer Network to Judaism Unbound. So, S.J. Selden, Shani Mink, welcome to Judaism Unbound. It's so great to have you.
It's so nice to be here.
I thought we could get started just with, how does a Jewish person in the 21st century, how do you become a Jewish farmer? What's your personal roots into becoming Jewish farmers?
we get asked this question all the time. And I think if you ask me tomorrow or next week, I would probably give you a different answer. I was always interested in being outside and doing outdoorsy things. And when I was in college, I started to get interested in agriculture a little bit. And I had a professor who got a CSA subscription from the farm that was local and said, hey, why don't you call this guy and see if you can get an internship on his farm? And I called him and he said, I don't do internships. I pay people for their time. And I said, great, can I have a job? And that was almost 10 years ago. And so I worked on that farm from about 6:30 in the morning till lunchtime through most of my college career. So I scheduled all my classes in the afternoon. So I came out of school with a degree in philosophy and also about 4 years of practical experience in organic agriculture.
Some people become Jewish farmers because they come from a long line of Jewish farmers that has not been broken or has not been broken in many generations. Like, just to name it, there are people who learn this from their parents and who are blessed to learn this from their grandparents and are a part of an unbroken chain of Jewish agriculturists. And I, to some degree, envy them for that continuity. For me, my last ancestors who were farmers were my great-grandparents. And I went to college studying systems of oppression in the United States and really wanted to be a part of building a more just and kind world, and knew that for my own health, I could not do that with an indoor job. I needed to find an outdoor work that was part of building that world that I was yearning for, that I think many of us are yearning for. And I took a road trip and realized through that the learning that comes from traveling that I didn't understand the food system, that I didn't have an experiential understanding of agriculture, despite being considered fully educated by having a college degree. And I called a friend of mine who I knew came from an agricultural family who was not Jewish. And I asked her, you know, how does this world work? My parents are business people and entrepreneurs. And I had no idea of what the entry point system was. And she very kindly explained to me about internships and apprenticeships and directed me towards a community farm. And I was blessed to be able to learn about how to farm by growing food for, with, and by community.
For a lot of people, the ways that they become a Jewish farmer is by becoming involved with the Jewish Farmer Network, because so many people that we meet, they are Jewish people who work on farms, but they would never really put those two pieces of their identity like together in like a sentence, like, I am a Jewish farmer. And so that like notion, it's like, oh, you're a Jewish farmer. People say like, oh, like I'm a farmer and I happen to be Jewish, is something that like we hear back from a lot of people. So another answer to that question is by hanging out with us.
That actually opens up a little bit of where I wanted to go. So Jewish Farmer Network is a cool name. And I'm sort of curious, like, it could be heard by people different ways, right? It's precisely as you just were talking about, Shani, like it could be heard as a set of farmers who are networked and Jewish Farmer Network. It could be heard as a farmer network or a farming network that is Jewish in the sense that it is like it has Jewish values or is like inflected through Jewish history or something. And I think it could be heard as both. I think that's part of the that points to a strong name if you could hear it multiple ways and sort of be spoken to in multiple ways. But I'm curious, like, if you were to sort of look at your organization, Jewish Farmer Network, and ask, like, to what extent is this about connecting people who are Jews and are farmers and helping them connect to each other? And to what extent is this about taking folks who are Jewish farmers and inflecting things through various Jewish lenses, whether they're textual or historical or cultural or whatever else?
It's both. And we try our best to make people feel and know that they are really welcome, regardless of what their Jewish experience or education is or isn't, and what their farming education is or isn't. So if you're an aspiring farmer who's never actually farmed yet, but you feel a yearning towards farming, we still want you to come in and engage with us. Same thing on the Jewish side. If you come from a Jewish tradition, but have felt distant from it, maybe because of your farming journey, a lot of our farmers say that they've felt unwelcome in Jewish spaces and unwelcome in their Jewish communities and unwelcome by the Jewish families because they've chosen to farm. We still want you to come and be with us and to learn with us, whether you have that Jewish education or whether you are coming to it knowing that you have Jewish ancestry or Jewish connection, but that's it. That's all you have. You have that thread, but really not a lot that's attached to it right now.
And I like the question about the name, because I remember five years ago, SJ and I like agonizing over like what we were going to call it. And then we ended up, we were like, let's just call it what it is, which is a network for Jewish farmers. And so people say Jewish Farmer Network, like, what's that? And I say, oh, it's a network for Jewish farmers. And I just like, I spit right back at them what they've just said to me. Sometimes I feel like I'm being maybe a little rude and cheeky, but like also like that is what it is. And like a lot of times people think like maybe they don't count, right? Or like maybe there isn't a space for them, or maybe the Judaism that people grew up with made them feel like, oh, I don't actually want to be involved with anything Jewish, even though it aligns with their lifestyle and aligns with their life as a farmer. And it takes like a little bit of work. It usually takes like a friend of theirs being like, no, actually, like, this is really cool. You should check out this thing. And then people are like, oh yeah, I am a Jewish farmer. And like, I do belong here. I feel like just like there's no right way to be Jewish, there is no right way to be a Jewish farmer. So perhaps it is just farming in a very secular way. And in your heart, you're Jewish, right? And like, you know that you're Jewish, and you go home and maybe you practice Shabbat and maybe you don't.
I think that there's a lot of cultural forgetting around our farming history. There's this notion that like, right, we were farmers when we were people living in ancient Israel, and then diaspora separated us from the land. And, you know, now in the 21st century is the first time, you know, we've been back to farming. And because these are stories that we don't often elevate, the stories of our ancestors who were milk farmers, the story of our ancestors who were growing vegetables on whatever scale, there's this cultural forgetting that we have been stewarding land, we have been stewarding animals, we have been growing vegetables continuously throughout our many diasporas over across thousands of years. So there are many ways to be a Jewish farmer, and some of those are informed by direct ancestral connection to our grandparents or great-grandparents. Some of that is the Torah of our hearts, right? Of us looking at our Judaism and feeling our Judaism and saying, this is how this maps onto my stewardship of land. And some of that is informed by the people around us who we learn from, who are not necessarily our direct ancestors, but who are part of, you know, the Jewish mishpacha, the Jewish family of Jewish farmers that we get to learn from. And, you know, I imagine that there is always tension in any field, all puns intended, about how best to go about this work. And something that we really emphasize at Jewish Farmer Network is that, you know, there are many streams, there are many ways. And what does it look like to have Jewish values and to have Jewish ancestral agricultural technology be at the center of our yearnings for what it looks like to be a Jewish farmer, not just a Jewish person who is farming, but someone who is having their Judaism deeply inform their agricultural practices.
Can you share with us some of the different approaches to being a Jewish farmer and making both of those words have real meaning?
I'm an alumni of like a lot of the programs within the Jaffe field, which is the Jewish Outdoors Food Farming and Environmental Education. And something that was an interesting experience for me was that like I kind of came through the Adama Fellowship and I was like, okay, we were farmers in ancient Israel, and then Adama was founded. Like I had like zero sense of the in-between. And so much of building this work with SJ has been like filling that in both through our research and through meeting people and finding out this like vast diversity of Jewish farming stories and like how it fits in also to like the story of agriculture in America. And it's been really interesting unearthing that. So I don't know if y'all are familiar at all with the Jewish Agricultural Society. So this was a project that was founded by Baron de Hirsch. He was a wealthy Jewish German philanthropist in the early 1900s, and he set up Jewish farming colonies kind of throughout North and South America. And you can see the remnants of them still today, but he wanted to set up a place for Jews, primarily Russian Jews, fleeing persecution in Europe to come and have like a safe place to land squarely in Jewish community. And he felt like agriculture was the way to do it, to give them a life and a livelihood. And we meet people all the time and we talk about our work and they're like, oh, I like vaguely remember hearing something about, you know, my great uncle on a chicken farm in South Jersey. And we're like, yes, like we know about that. It's really interesting. And so there are these communities in California, in Connecticut. We actually have a farmer in our network Frank Himmelstein, who his family has been on the same piece of land that was, you know, given by Baron de Hirsch for over 100 years. And it's so beautiful to hear these people. They feel so tied to this story. And it was so much, it was such a crucial piece of their family finding safety in the new world.
I want to put air quotes around new world, because one of the things that I think Baron de Hirsch's work did not, and the Jewish Cultural Society's work did not take into consideration, at least in a thoughtful, ethical way, was it was very much set up as a colonization project, which meant that it was complicit in the colonization of Turtle Island, of so-called New World, and was trying to create Jewish safety on land with no notion of how Jewish safety is inextricable from Indigenous safety and from the safety of Indigenous peoples. So I think that just to uplift, like, this was a philanthropist who was trying really hard to create Jewish safety, saw that as being happening through land, happening through food security and food sovereignty, but wasn't taking into that larger kind of collective liberation vision of actually Jews aren't safe unless everyone is safe. Jews aren't safe unless all people have safety on land. And I think that that is kind of a core difference between, you know, 100 years later, how we think of our work at Jewish Farmer Network versus how the Jewish Agricultural Society's work was positioned at its time.
I'm flashing back to our conversation with David Seidenberg a while back. And the core thesis statement of that conversation, it wasn't only in that one, we've brought this up a number of times, but it's basically the point that, like, one does not own land. First off, according to Jewish texts, and maybe for many of us, not just according to Jewish texts, according to other philosophies that are important to us that we cherish. And he spoke about that, you know, Shemitah, the sabbatical year, is this reiteration of that in the Jubilee year, where property sort of reverts back in a sense to being to whoever owned it at an earlier point. And it's just hammering home that no. If you think you own this land, you don't. From the Bible's perspective, it's God's, right? But, like, for some, it might be that it's God's. For some, it might be that it's just, you know, earth. It's just itself that we can't own, that we are temporary dwellers on. And so I was curious to open up with the two of you some of the broader political considerations that inform your work, because, like, one could imagine, right? Like, there could be a Jewish farmer network in a parallel universe that is striving to just be not particularly, in quotes, political, right? Like, there's lots of organizations that try to do that. We've talked on this show about how that doesn't really work, and apolitical work is still political work. But you have been very straightforward about how, no, we're not just like a set of farmers, and we're not even just a set of farmers inflecting things through Jewish values. We're actually also considering the broader web of political issues that connect to this work. So how does that come up for you as a Jewish Farmer Network, and what does it look like to sort of take principles as a network and sort of channel them into the world?
First, we are a very diverse network, so we have a very broad range of political and ideological beliefs amongst our members, and there's no litmus test for what you have to believe in order to be a part of a Jewish Farmer Network. Truly, anyone at the intersection of Judaism and agriculture who's committed to the safety of each other and who's willing to be in what we call, what we reference as this Jewish value of holy disagreements, argument for the sake of heaven, is like welcome to come and wrestle with us. And Shani and I talk about wanting to create a community of question askers. And so I think that the questions that we are asking collectively as a network of Jewish farmers is, what does it mean to steward land and to grow food with our ancestral values and ethics guiding that process? So in all of these conversations, it is that invitation into the collective wrestling of, okay, well, what are Jewish agricultural values? And then therefore, how do they guide our work? One of our dear friends and teachers, Justin Goldstein, talks about at the core of Jewish agriculture, if you had to boil it down to two words, it's everybody eats. So then I think then the question becomes, well, what is required to create a world where everybody eats? And some of those things we see through Shemitah, through this seventh year of rest and remission, which is encouraging us to create a world where we are doing longitudinal planning to have a multifaceted food system where we're eating wild foods and fermented foods, and we're storing foods collectively and then redistributing them to make sure that everyone has access to food. So, like, Jewish agriculture is a system of redistribution of food and resources. It's at the core of our ethics that there are times throughout the year where we give food that does not belong to the farmer. It belongs to the people who do not have food already. And the farmer's job is to reunite that food with its the person who already it is already due to. That same principle applies to money as well. There are regular points of redistribution. And so many of our holidays, particularly our agricultural holidays, which are many of our holidays, the pilgrimage festivals, include a moment of redistribution. It's central to that point, and it's central to the celebration that you share your abundance. We see this particularly with Sukkot, where it's this holiday of joy. And what is joy? Joy is sharing what you have, sharing the abundance of your harvest with the people around you. And there's this text that if you don't, your food becomes, your food turns to shit if you don't share it on Sukkot. So I think that that value of you share or this waste becomes like sadness in your hand is really central to Jewish agriculture. And we see this in other values such as peah and shichacha. So peah being giving the corner, designating the corner of your field for kind of this trio of the poor, the widow, the orphan, which is used to represent people who don't have access to land and don't have access to food. Shichacha, which is the forgotten sheaf, the idea that if you forget food in your field while you're harvesting, that it no longer belongs to you. You can't just turn around and grab it. And there are, of course, many laws and slicings of when you can and can't pick this up. But the basic principle is if you drop it, it's not yours anymore. And I think part of the work of modern Jewish farmers is to say, many places don't have robust gleaning systems in the same way that we imagine our ancestors had robust systems of gleaning, where someone's coming after you to pick through your field and get that forgotten sheaf and coming into your field to get that corner of field that is peah. So what does it look like to build systems of redistribution so that that food does get into the hands of people who otherwise would not have it and to whom it already belongs?
What's interesting about Shemitah particular and some other things that like these other principles that may not like technically apply outside of the land of Israel is that we get to reimagine them. Shemitah, you don't have to practice it outside of Israel. So the question is, okay, we don't have to, but we do get to learn from it, right? We do have the opportunity to be in a community of question askers wrestling with the idea of how do we incorporate this ancient visionary agricultural technology and also economic technology into our work as modern Jewish farmers in ways that are meaningful for us and keep us engaged with the wisdom of our tradition. And it's amazing to see like the breadth of things and in the ingenuity of folks in our community and the ways that they come to embody this ancient body of wisdom.
How do Jewish farmers that are not so religious or that are not so believing, how do they look at the sources for the types of values that you just described? You know, like if it's God that tells you, you know, you don't own the land and you don't own this food and you have to, you know, then it's like, okay, well, then I guess maybe the only question is, yeah, but technically that's only in the land of Israel, so we don't really have to do it. And they're like, okay, well, we can be inspired by it. But what if you really kind of don't believe that at all? You know, as that God commanded it, but at the same time, you want to really take seriously the idea of a contemporary Jewish farming ethic in the same way that other denominations of Judaism have come along and done different things with what happens in the synagogue. So can you talk a little bit more about how some of those conversations go or how you have those kinds of conversations or those learnings or those debates? What happens?
I think for a lot of people, it doesn't matter so much the idea that like God commanded it as much as it really matters to them that it's part of a tradition, right? Like it's like a cultural piece. This is the body of wisdom that our people have like protected and passed down through thousands and thousands and thousands of years. And so this gets to be the body of wisdom that's ours, right? Because a lot of people are searching for a deeper depth of meaning. They're looking for something to connect to. And whether it's like, you know, capital G-O-D, or it's just like this cultural piece, it feels really meaningful.
Jewishness, I would say, has always been a culture. And that our kind of mapping of Judaism as a religion onto modern Judaism, there are some ways in which we do that are really a function of living in a world shaped by Christian hegemony. So for people to appreciate that these pieces of wisdom come through their culture, and that that is enough, and that they don't have to ascribe to a doctrine of belief rooted in the belief in a God, but that they can just be kind of cozied up with their ancestors and cozied up with their ancestral wisdom and feel accompanied by those pieces as they farm is tremendously comforting for people. And that is also in some ways a refutation of allowing Judaism to be shaped in relationship or in opposition to Christianity by saying, I can be a Jewish farmer and that has nothing to do necessarily with my belief in a higher power.
Culture is first off, agriculture ends in culture, right? Like culture is an agricultural word. A lot of words that we use all the time trace their way back to like metaphors of growing stuff. And I think that if we actually were to sort of look at that and interrogate what is happening with some of the words we use all the time, culture, what would it mean if we thought of Jewish culture as the set of things that Jews grow together? Like that'd be a cool, obviously it's like a metaphor, right? But like, it's interesting. So putting that maybe aside, but it might actually relate to this. I want to throw some shade at the Talmudic rabbis for a second, because I'm constantly upset with them about a set of things. I'm also thrilled with them about other things. But I'm super into this text, the Mishnah, which is the first beginnings of the rabbinic tradition. It comes around 200 CE. And then the Talmud comes along and it looks at the Mishnah and it says, cool ideas, friends, predecessors, we're going to ditch a lot of them and not talk about them at all. And we're going to talk about what we want to talk about. And what it does, it says, here are the six orders of the Mishnah. It starts off right at the beginning with an entire order, chapter upon chapter, tractate upon tractate, about agriculture. It's called seeds, Zera'im. And it says, bye. We don't need any Talmud on any of that. We're going to ditch everything about Peah, that beautiful idea you just mentioned with setting aside the corner of the field. Everything about Kilayim, which things you can grow next to each other. Everything about Bikurim, the first fruits. We're going to throw it all to the side, and we're not going to have full Talmud tractates on that. We're going to have just the little section on blessings, which is in that same section on seeds. What an interesting idea that blessings are seeds. And then we're going to skip forward to the holidays. And I think that's so misguided. And I think it's part of why we've come to a place as a collective where we think that farming was just Bible. And then it jumped to, you know, what you talked about with Adama 21st century. Like our Talmud's rabbis actually made that choice. And it's not that they fully erased this stuff. They did allude to it in some of their commentaries, conversations. But I want to name it because it's not just that through happenstance or historical evolutions, our people has come to a place where we don't think of ourselves as farmers. It's actually that some rabbis in, you know, 3rd through 6th centuries made that call. And I know that's like, maybe some would say that's like a heretical thing to say, to throw shade at the rabbis. But I'm curious if that resonates for you or lands for you, because I'm always hesitant just to just pretend that like, ugh, it was history. Like history just happened, as opposed to a set of Jews made some decisions at different points, and we can make decisions at our point. And we can say, ah, farming is going to be central to how we conceptualize Jewishness, Judaism today.
When we think about the Talmud and all commentary on Torah as a project in Jewish continuity, as how do we take an earth-based tradition, a land-based tradition, and retain a sense of peoplehood outside of our land base, the decisions that the rabbis made tend to make more sense. The choices of, well, what do we leave behind to survive, I think become both more clear and also more heartbreaking of what can we no longer afford to carry with us. And that makes me very, very sad, the ways that I think Judaism has kind of left behind its agricultural, it feels aggressive to say left behind its agricultural roots, but at least put them in the corner, kind of put our cultural roots in the corner because of a belief that we need to do that in order to survive. So there's a really powerful paper that has informed a lot of my learning and teaching called From Farmers to Merchants, A Human Capital Interpretation of Jewish Economic History by Maricela Bottesini and Zvi Eckstein. I pulled it up on my computer.
For those listening, we'll have a link in the show notes.
Thank you. And it talks about this. It has this really powerful graph that shows the percentage of Jewish farmers throughout time, starting, I believe, just before the turning of the Common Era, and the ways that that just kept shrinking from a majority population of farmers to a population that was a tiny minority of farmers. And I think about the ways in which every time you are forcibly displaced from land, it becomes that much harder to say, okay, I'm going to try to farm again. I'm going to see if I can figure out the seasons and the flow of water on this place. I'm going to see if my seeds take root here. It just becomes more and more heartbreaking each time to try to learn how to farm again in a new place and try to navigate the structures of power around you that are constantly telling you, you know, who and what you can and can't do as a Jew, as a minority. And the choices that early Jewish leaders in diaspora made was to push for literacy, to say, okay, well, if we can't show that we're Jewish anymore by bringing agricultural sacrifices to a temple that no longer exists, then we're going to say that prayer replaces sacrifice. And if that's true, then we need to have an educated population who knows how to read and who can show up physically to a Beit Midrash, a house of study, to learn together. And something that we've talked about a lot in Jewish Farmer Network is uplifting this term of an Am Haaretz, a person of the land, the way that that's used in Talmudic references to mean an ignoramus, someone who's ignorant of the laws of tithing, someone who's ignorant, who can't read, and the ways in which for thousands of years, we've conflated the idea of a Jewish farmer as someone who is not actually a part of the Jewish community in a way that we honor and uplift. But there's been this bifurcation, the separation of considering Jewish farmers part of the center of our people for 2,000 years. And then that rift really happened at the beginning of diaspora when it became harder to be a Jewish farmer because all the ways of being a Jewish farmer and how that was honored and centralized were removed from us. And I think that there was also maybe a taste of hurt. Again, like it hurt too much to be a Jewish farmer in the ways that were because so many of those structures were no longer available to us. So we chose new ones and it left people behind.
When we think about something like the Jewish Farmer Network, I always think about, or like any kind of new movement or grouping within the Jewish world, I think about like, well, what are we aspiring toward? Like, do you imagine that farming should become, or, you know, do you imagine, or is it your aspiration that farming should become something that many more Jews are doing as a kind of full-time endeavor? Do you imagine that it would be good if a vast number of more Jews kind of incorporated farming in some way into their lives? Like, how do you start to see a positive, restorative, or healing vision of, you know, where we bring farming back into a more natural part of Judaism? Like, where does that lead us?
I often think about the fact that I grew up sitting in a sukkah every year with like plastic grapes hanging in the corner of the sukkah and like weird plastic like chandeliers in the shape of pineapples. And how the fact that Sukkot is an agricultural holiday was like totally lost on me until I started farming. So I feel like a big part of our work is restoring the understanding of Judaism as an agrarian people. And the way that we're doing that, or one of the ways that we're doing that, is by uplifting the stories of modern Jewish farmers. And I think that one of our big goals there is that so right now what we hear from a lot of our farmers is that when they go back to their family and they say, hey mom, like hey grandpa, I'm gonna go work on this farm this summer, I'm so excited. What we've heard over and over and over again from people is that what they hear back is, oh, Jewish farmer, isn't that an oxymoron? And it's so annoying. And also it's so limiting. And it tells that person, okay, you can't fully embody your farmer self in a Jewish space. Part of the shift that we're trying to make is from Jewish farmers being like anomalies or like weirdos to like Jewish farmers being like actually a really crucial piece of the Jewish community that have a really unique and innate and embodied connection to a piece of Judaism that has been ignored for centuries. How do we take these pieces of Jewish wisdom that have also been regarded as metaphor for centuries, largely, and turn them into something that can actually shape the way that we're moving in the world today? When I started farming, it felt like a huge stretch for me, right? It felt like, oh, I don't know, do people like me do work like this? And so we're like blowing up uplifting, celebrating the stories of the full diversity of the farmers in our network so that the next generation doesn't have that hurdle to overcome. So we're doing that. And we're also like slowly getting out and trying to like build connections between farmers and their local Jewish community. Why shouldn't synagogues be taking trips to, you know, a local Jewish farm on Sukkot or on Shavuot, maybe a wheat farm on Shavuot, like maybe take people to a farm on Pesach. Like, why not go to see a Jewish farmer, a Jewish farm, a Jewish orchardist for, you know, when you're going apple picking before Rosh Hashanah? So really just trying to like uplift that so that the next generation doesn't have to hear constantly, Jewish farmer, isn't that an oxymoron?
I really appreciate you say that. And the rhetorical questions you just asked, I mean, I'm going to answer cynically with the reason they're not showing that is that some communities, maybe less now, but if we flash back a decade, some communities, they would not have looked at somebody becoming a farmer as opposed to a doctor or a lawyer or whatever and said, oh, that's great. And we should, and we need to say that. It's a problem that we've set up our Jewish society. It's very much we've centered traditional upper middle class to upper class kinds of positions in society. And the fact that we can make chuckle jokes about how all Jews are doctors and lawyers and accountants or whatever, I don't know, folks. I think we gotta seriously back out and think about like what has led to that and whether farming could be a part of a broader conversation about how we stop restricting the image of like what Jews do in the world to this very narrow vision of like, let's be blunt, like jobs associated with affluence. First off, that's not actually true about Jews of the past, even as we've set it up as sort of the image. It certainly isn't true now, and I hope will continue to not be true. On a related front, maybe, I was curious to bring up something that we'll link to some of these articles in the show notes, but some of the articles about the Jewish Farmer Network have been really great at diving into like who are Jewish farmers, right? And what one of them in particular really honed in on is that there are a lot of trans and non-binary Jewish farmers. And what kind of amazing role is it to be a kind of space that is proving to be not only open, but like actively empowering to trans and non-binary folks when in a lot of other corners of the Jewish community, that's not the case. And also like, to the extent that you can tell, like, what is it about farming or that is drawing disproportionately folks who are trans and non-binary to your network?
Nature is queer. Nature is non-binary. To be a farmer is to be up close and personal with plants and with animals that do not evenly map onto the gender binary that we're presented oftentimes as immutable truth, incorrectly presented as immutable truth in within human anatomy and human sexuality and human gender. To be able to be surrounded by corn that is intersex, that has flowers, quote unquote, male parts where there should be female parts, should be quote unquote female parts, and vice versa, I think allows people to see themselves, allows queer and trans and non-binary people to see themselves reflected in nature in a way that is not necessarily, we don't necessarily see ourselves reflected in human society, at least in human society when we're growing up in a world that's so shaped by cissexism and by homophobia. And by the idea that to be cis is to be the norm and to be straight is to be the norm. Nature and the natural world and the world that we encounter through farming reminds and affirms for a lot of queer farmers and trans farmers and non-binary farmers that like we are just as much a part of nature as that corn is. We are just as much a part of nature as the goats who are both female, who are looking at each other in a way that is very clearly sexual. Like there's just a way in which we are affirmed by the farmscape and by the landscape in a way that a lot of times our human societies don't affirm us growing up. I think that a lot of people who are queer, trans, non-binary seek out farming because of a desire to be in the natural world that is so healing, and sometimes because of a desire to be further from the human world that is often so harmful that people seek refuge. Unfortunately, for a lot of people, those places are not a refuge, and there's a lot of work that needs to be done on farms to make sure that these are safe and affirming workplaces for trans, non-binary, and queer people. But once we're there, once we're on the farm and we see ourselves reflected in nature and we feel the healing of feeling held by a world that is not trying to figure out what or who we are, that's not trying to dissect our appearance and figure out what to do then next, it's hard to leave, I think, for a lot of us. And I can only speak as myself, and I don't speak for the whole community of trans, queer, non-binary people, but for me, it was very hard to leave once I felt myself reflected and saw myself in the landscape around me. And I've heard similar things from other people who share some of my identities. And I think in terms of Jewish Farmer Network and why we have so many queer, trans, and non-binary farmers is because there are so many queer, trans, and non-binary Jewish farmers. There just are many of us. And there are many queer, trans, non-binary Jews who are not farming. And I think the question that I want to ask back out to institutions that don't see those parts of their community in them is, why don't you? Where are the queer, trans, non-binary people who are already part of your community, and why don't they feel safe or feel welcome or feel desire to be in your community? I feel really blessed that we are a community that is so full in these ways. And I think part of what has allowed that to remain true is that we continue to uplift the leadership of our queer, trans, and non-binary community members. And we raise money to fund people who are organizing within our community to help them keep organizing in our community. And we really try to continue to ask, what are we missing? What would make this space feel more like home for you?
What I've heard from trans and genderqueer folks in our community is that being on a farm is very like liberating, to just be like a person in a body in the world, rather than being like in a city and like a space where like people are constantly trying to like squish you into the gender binary. And so I guess it's just like our hope that other farming organizations start uplifting those voices, because they're such crucial members of our community.
What is the function of the Jewish Farmer Network as you see it? Meaning, is it largely to create a space for the farmers to feel like we have a community, we have to lift us up and to share with, and et cetera? Or is it to project something into the larger Jewish community? And as you were talking earlier, I was thinking about how it's become this kind of cliche that there's tikkun olam is a Jewish value, right? And people are like, that's not an important Jewish value historically or whatever, but at a certain point in relatively recent history, Jews got into this idea of tikkun olam, which granted was a relatively smaller idea from the Kabbalah later, right? And have elevated it. And now, at least for example, in the Reform movement, it's a huge concept. And I think it's important to say it is a huge Jewish concept. You want to say it wasn't a huge Jewish concept 2000 years ago? Fine, but it's a huge Jewish concept now and totally legitimate to be seen as one. And as you were talking, I was thinking about that in terms of, and I don't know that we have like the Jewish watchword yet for it, but basically land values, especially as they attach to something that really is an existential crisis for the world, which is climate change. It feels to me that there's a possibility here that out of a flourishing, perhaps small, world of Jewish farming, there may be certain new ideas and values, or old new ideas and values, that get reinfused into the Jewish world writ large at a point at which we really need them. So I guess I'm wondering whether and to what extent those are explicit goals and wishes for the Jewish Farmer Network, or whether they are or not, whether you see some of that happening, whether you want them, whether you're amplifying them, or how does that connection between the larger Jewish community and those who are really going to be dedicated to farming in a serious way, how do you explore those points of connection?
I think I want to start by saying that our obligation is like first and foremost to the farmers that are in our network. Our work there is to connect them to each other and to connect them to the rich body of Jewish agricultural wisdom. I often think of that as like story repair. For a lot of the Jewish farmers in our network, when they're in Jewish spaces, they're the only farmer. When they're in farming spaces, they're the only Jew. And so they feel really isolated in the world. And so we're offering them the spaces where they can connect at these two pieces of identity, and often three, and often sometimes even four pieces of identity. So we have like subgroups for queer Jewish farmers, right? And disabled Jewish farmers as three. I don't know where I got the four from, but so those are like our first obligation is to them. And I think that by bolstering this subcommunity of the Jewish community that has been largely overlooked by mainstream Jewish institutions for ages, I have full faith that that will have like a rippling effect out into the rest of the Jewish community. So maybe it's in the realm of Shemitah, and maybe it's in the realm of like, you know, Yovel, and what does it look like to rematriate the land to the original stewards? And like, maybe it starts within the Jewish farming community, and then it ripples out to the rest. And to have these conversations about what does it mean to like give a land tax as a Jewish farmer, but like also all of our Jewish institutions should be giving a land tax to the original stewards of that land. Maybe they're not fully at the point of rematriation, but like, let's give that land tax. That's part of our tradition. I don't know if I can like crystallize down to like something as discreet as like Tikkun Olam, and this is going to be our big stamp on the Jewish community. But I think that we are educating and nurturing and supporting this group of the subgroup of the Jewish community that is going to be champions of these pieces of Jewish wisdom that have been seen as mere metaphors for ages.
I love that. I love that your primary responsibility. I love that you use the term obligation. I think that it's a powerful and Jewishly laden term, like that your obligation is primarily to those who are Jewish farmers. I do have a question for maybe it's not your role, maybe it's the role of others who are adjacent to you are working with you, like say folks interviewing you on a podcast. But like, I have a question which is about like the projection out to the rest of the Jews or the rest of the world, because I'm flashing to a conversation we had. This is going to not make sense at first, with Sean Leisha, who is Karaite, who is a Karaite Jew. And we were talking all about Karaite Judaism, Karaite being like a kind of Jew that is not a rabbinic Jew for purposes of this conversation and is not very common today. There's only around like 25, 30,000 folks around. And we asked Sean, would you be happy if there are, like, it's probably the case, I mean, he said this, that there will not be Karaites who identify as Karaites as part of the American Jewish population for much longer. It's just a really small group, and the challenges to maintaining it are really hard. But what there could be is thousands upon thousands of people who better familiarize themselves with what it is to be a Karaite and maybe incorporate some element of it into their Jewish practice. And so I bring that up because my question is, you are doing an amazing service or set of services to Jewish farmers. What about the people who aren't Jewish farmers but are like, I've sort of played around in my head with the idea of like trying out farming, and I have a suspicion that it could have a major impact on how I exist in the world and how I exist as a Jew. But like, look, I'm not going to be a farmer as like my primary. I'm not going to like sculpt my life around that. What would you sort of say to those folks? Or by the way, would those folks excite you? Like, to me, it would be exciting if we had thousands upon thousands of people who aren't necessarily farmers, like as the occupation or as like how they live their lives, but have farmed and it impacts them.
I feel so lucky that our organization exists in an ecosystem of other Jewish farming related organizations that offer opportunities for folks like that. Jewish educational farms that exist as kind of sometimes as independent organizations or as pieces of synagogues, such as Abundance Farm in Northampton, Massachusetts, Ikar Farm in Denver, Urban Adama in Berkeley, Adamad, Isabella Friedman, Milk and Honey Farm at the JCC in Boulder. So all of these organizations exist, I think, as a really meaningful entry point for people to engage in this stuff without changing their entire life and, you know, leaving the city and becoming a full-on farmer. And so we're so grateful to have those people as participants in our programming, and also so glad that they have all of these other outputs to engage in Jewish agricultural ideals.
Something that I'm thinking about is, particularly amongst millennials, there's this often quoted thing about how many times millennials will change jobs. For knowing that people have many jobs throughout their lives, like for one of those jobs to be a farmer, will inevitably infuse that person's work and paradigm for the rest of their lives. So for Jewish people to have more, both for there to be more people who are Jewish farmers full-time, I think is good for the Jewish community for a number of reasons, and will also benefit the farming community for a number of reasons. But additionally, to have people who have had a taste of farming, who understand a little bit better how the food system works, and who understand a little bit better what it takes to grow food, and understand a little bit better the various ways in which Judaism and agriculture are an intersecting piece of wisdom in so many ways, I think is beneficial to the Jewish community writ large. It allows people to, again, see our tradition literally grounded in agriculture, not metaphorically alluding to agriculture, in a way that allows the tradition to be, I think, meaningful on its own terms. So much of what I find meaningful about Jewish agriculture is that it connects me to Judaism that predates our trauma. And for that taste of Judaism to be in people's mouths because they've experienced agriculture feels like a powerful form of healing for all of our Jewish communities.
Just as a closing note, we're thrilled to be speaking with you specifically around Shemitah, and we have discussed that over the course of this episode, but I know that you have a particular project called Shemitah Plots. Tell us about Shemitah Plots as we head out.
We wanted to give folks an kind of like embodied tactical, practical way of engaging in Shemitah. And so folks are able to sign up to, or they're really committing to designating a piece of their land to rest for the Shemitah year. And so we have folks who have just like a community garden plot that they've committed to letting lay fallow for the Shemitah year. And then we have folks that have committed, you know, 1 out of 8 acres on their land to lie fallow for the year. And we've set them up with Shemitah buddies to be able to kind of like talk about the experience of like, okay, what does it feel like to release control and to let the land do its thing? Like, what are you observing? What is it doing? What kind of weeds are coming up? Like, what does it feel like to not be able to mow it down? What does it feel like to like not be bodily engaged with that piece of land and to just kind of let it do its thing? And so we have, I think, like 25 people signed up already across the country. And it's real. And like, you know, like I said, from as small as a plot to like as big as an acre to as big as like a whole farm. So we have a Jewish farming family in our community in North Carolina that are largely like secular. And they have decided to let their entire farm lay fallow. They're like, they are really, really going for it with the Shemitah year. And I can't imagine like another time when that's like really happened for secular Jews. I don't know, in recent time, like I can't think of another time that's happened. I'm so inspired by the fact that they were so inspired by this concept that they're really taking a full step back, and they're also podcasters. And so they've been like talking a lot about their process and like, why did they choose to do this? And it's been amazing to see them really connect to this piece of Jewish wisdom and bring it to life.
Thank you so much, Shani and SJ, for joining us. This has been a fantastic conversation.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thank you so much to all of you out there for listening. We hope you've enjoyed this conversation, and we hope that you'll tune in again in the future. Before we tell you all the different ways that you can be in touch with us, one important note is that we've got the Jewish Farmer Network Conference approaching. It is split into two parts, January 30th and February 6th, and you can sign up, you can register at their website, jewishfarmernetwork.org. And if for some reason you want to find it a different way, you can head to our show notes, which contain a link to the conference registration. So definitely check that out. We encourage you to attend and learn more from Shani and SJ and connect with all the other Jewish farmers that are part of their network and others who are curious to learn more about it. We will now, of course, close out by mentioning all the different ways that you can be in touch with us. And here they are. First, there's our Facebook and Twitter and Instagram handles. All of those are just at Judaism Unbound. Second, you can head to our website, judaismunbound.com. And third, you can email us via dan@judaismunbound.com or lex@judaismunbound.com. The last request we'd like to make is that you can always support us financially via a donation at judaismunbound.com/donate, and you can do that on either a monthly recurring basis or just as a one-time gift. So thank you so much for listening, and with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.